Good afternoon. So last time we talked about making networking quote unquote secure. And there were kind of two security properties we focused on because, well, they're the most common ones that people are concerned about. One was what we called confidentiality, which is the idea that even if we have an attacker who can intercept and manipulate our messages, they shouldn't be able to figure out the contents of messages that aren't intended for them. And we mentioned we had a way of achieving this confidentiality goal with a tool we called encryption. And we had two variants of encryption we talked about. We had the symmetric version, where we had one key, something kind of akin to a password, and the encryption essentially scrambled our messages based on that single key. And we had this other version we called asymmetric encryption, where we had a key pair. We had a public key and a private key, and anyone could use a public key to encrypt something that could then only be decrypted, you know, undo the encryption with the private key. We had the second problem we wanted to solve as far as the security property wasn't confidentiality, was what we called authenticity, which is the name we use for making sure that when we get a message that we know it actually came from the party who we assume it came from and that it wasn't changed in transit, even if we have some sort of attacker. And we had this tool where we'd add what we called either a tag or a signature to a message that we could use to verify that it was sent by the correct party, and we know this because that party would be in possession of a key that needed to be used to produce that tag or signature. And like with encryption, we had two variants here. We had message authentication codes, which produced these tags and used a single key. And we had an asymmetric version we called digital signatures, where there was a private key that was used to sign messages, meaning produce a digital signature, and a public key that was used to verify signatures were actually produced with the private key and actually produced using the message that we're checking. Then we mentioned that even though we have these kind of powerful tools that some mathematical experts would produce for us, that they were still kind of easy to use improperly. And our biggest example of that was this problem of replay attacks, that if we had a message that was encrypted or and authenticated, we could still, you know, copy that message and resend it later, and we could get confused because we'd be missing the context that was originally intended for that message. And the fix for this kind of problem is to add extra context to the message, to make it so that when it's copied, it can't be reinterpreted in some other way. And we saw the primary mechanism for doing this is what we call the nonce, a number used once, where we kind of mark the messages with where they came from, and provided we check that later on, we will know that they don't belong if you receive them out of place. So then once we talked about these tools, we actually had this big practical issue, which is that, you know, this idea was fine for, you know, just two people we want to communicate with, but that's not the scenario we have on the real internet. We want every web browser to communicate with every website. And a big problem is we have to somehow get our key information to every browser from every website. And having our asymmetric encryption and digital signatures made this a bunch easier because we could just broadcast these public keys. We didn't have to care about keeping them secret, but we still needed to make sure the public key actually came from the right place. And sort of the thing we do in practice for that is use the certificate authority. So we have our certificate authority sign a message saying, hey, the public key for foo.com is this, and our browser, you know, sort of has a hard-coded list of certificate authorities and their public keys in order to verify those messages. We call those messages the certificate, and for better or worse, our browser trusts those certificate authorities to verify the identities of websites, where by identity I mean the public key. And I note that I'm using the word trust, which is not the same as saying that they are trustworthy, just that the reality is that our web browsers do actually trust them. So that's what we covered last time. And for most of the rest of the semester, we're going to be talking about a completely different topic dealing with hardware. But before I move on to that, questions about things we covered last time with sort of secure communication. Okay, so then we're going to move on to a completely different topic of sort of how processors work. And we're going to kind of expand on stuff that was covered in CS01. And I think this is something like the CPU model we had in CS01. So, and this is a model we're going to start with and extend. So we want to make sure we're comfortable with what's going on here. And in these pictures, I'm going to draw with this sort of thing down here. This is a register, and this particular register is the program counter. As we move on, we'll have some other registers that I'll draw with the same notch symbol at the bottom. And this register, that's the program counter. We send the program counter value to our instruction cache, which I represent with an I dollar sign, to retrieve the actual machine code for that instruction. And there's a bunch of things we need to do with that machine code. One of the things is that's going to tell us what registers we want to read from the register file, which contains our sort of all the registers we see in assembly except for the program counter. And we're going to use that to do some math. What math we do depends on the instruction. And then for some instructions, we're going to access the data cache to load or store a value from memory, you know, outside our machine code. And in either case, we'll usually have some value either from memory or from our computation to write to the register file. So this is kind of the high-level notion of how we might execute an instruction. And in this kind of design, our assumption is that while we're doing all this work to actually run the instruction, we also are computing the next PC value, and that sits on the input to the program counter until we advance to the next instruction. And we're going to say that we have some sort of clock that controls how we advance. And so in this design, every clock cycle, we run one instruction. When the clock cycle ends, we advance the program counter, we finish the writes to the register file, and move on to the next instruction. So to give a more concrete example of what this might look like, let's say we're running this add and this move instruction. And my assumption is that the add instruction is at address 100 and the move is at address 108. Initially, our program counter will contain address 100. That will be sent to the instruction cache. It's going to output our register indices 8 and 9, so the register file knows what to read. Our register file will retrieve those values, which were originally 800 and 900, send them to this math circuit, which will realize based on other information in the machine code that it needs to do an add, and it will compute the sum 1100, send that to the register file. The register file will use that to actually do a write and update the value of R9 when we move on, you know, to the next instruction. And meanwhile, we've computed the address 108, the address of the move instruction. And so this means when we advance to the next clock cycle, now everything will be happening in the same kind of way, but starting with a program counter value of 108. So we'll have 108, the address of the move instruction. That will cause us to retrieve registers numbers 10 and 11, and also the value 0x12345 from the machine code. Our math part will compute the address that we actually want to access in the data cache. The data cache will do its read, and that will eventually end up going to our register file and being used to update register 11. And while that happens, we'll compute the address of the next instruction to run, preparing for the next clock cycle. So this is kind of something like the processor design we talked about in CS01, like how it works and how it executes instructions. I want to make sure we're comfortable with this because we're going to be adding things onto this that will be confusing, probably even if you do understand this, so we want to make sure we're comfortable right now. Questions on our single cycle processor design? I'm calling it single cycle because it executes every instruction in one clock cycle, and then we move on to the next sort of all at once. Okay. So the first step that we're going to talk about is kind of a way in which, if we think of this from a kind of human perspective, it seems like we're doing something very inefficient. And that inefficient thing is that we're, if we think of executing this add instruction, we're reading from the instruction cache. And then from that point on, the instruction cache has done its work. It's gotten the 8 and 9 out of the instruction, and we kind of don't need it anymore. But we wait for the entire process of getting the values out of the register file and, you know, computing our new value and sending it back to the register file before the instruction cache moves on to the next instruction. So not only are we doing one instruction at a time, that we're like doing all the steps of the instruction and before we move on to the next instruction. And there's some contexts where I think most people would intuitively say, this is not how we should operate. So if we think of a physical analogy I'll start with, of let's say I'm doing some laundry. And I have two loads of laundry to do. What our processor is doing is kind of like this timeline here, that I take my first load of laundry, I put it in the washer, wait for that to finish. Our washer is kind of like our instruction cache, you know, then move things to the dryer. You might think of like our register file read. And then I fold it. Then I'm finally done with the first load of laundry, and only then do I move on to the next load. So who here does loads of laundry like this? If you have two loads of laundry to do, who here, this would be like a reasonable timeline for you. No one. So we have this kind of intuition that, you know, this is kind of silly because there's all this time here when the washer is doing nothing. And we have the same problem in our circuit where it looks like we have all this time when our instruction cache is doing nothing, or our register file read circuit's doing nothing, and so on. And what we kind of would do in person is we say, well, after I finish doing the first load of laundry in the washer, I should do the next one just right away if the washer is available. And we'd end up with a timeline something like this, where we end up getting, you know, more work done in the same amount of time. So we're going to figure out how to apply this kind of intuition that, you know, if we have components that don't need the whole time for an instruction to run to do something, we can do one instruction's work, then the next right away before the instruction's fully finished. Just like here, you know, I can use the washer for the next load of laundry before the first load is actually done. That's a perfectly fine thing to do, and that's going to get me a lot of sort of overall efficiency. And to think about kind of the implications of this before we talk about adding it to our circuit, let's look at something a little bit here. So here we have this little gap here. So we have this little bit of wasted time. And this is actually going to repeat if we think of doing another load, right? We'd have another little gap. And that's because we kind of have to wait behind the previous load. So in this case, I can't actually, usefully start my third load of laundry here until, I have space in the washer, and I can't really clear the washer until the dryer is free. And more realistically, what this is going to look like is that my dryer is not nearly as fast as my washer, so it's probably going to look something like this. So we have all this time we're spending, just waiting that we didn't have before. If we look at our kind of original timeline, yes, I wasn't using the washer here, but I didn't have to wait in between anything. Here we have this kind of extra time, where things aren't being usefully done. And if we think of how long it takes from when we start a load of laundry to when we finish a load of laundry, I'm doing loads of laundry slower. That my time here, which we know is from beginning to end, which we'll call the latency, is longer. So we're going to call this idea of like moving on to from one stage to the next pipelining. So with pipelining, our latency is a little over 2 hours with this diagram. If I was just doing one load of laundry, then moving on to the next, it's faster in terms of latency. But we intuitively would never do our laundry in the way that gets the lower latency. Even though it's faster, it is the fastest way to make sure we do each load of laundry fastest from beginning to end. And that no one would choose to do laundry in this way that gets the lowest latency tells us that latency, it's a useful metric sometimes, and it's a very common, easy metric, but it's not what we care about when doing laundry, right? What we really care about is sort of how long it takes to do lots of load of laundry overall, taking into account that their work can overlap. And the same thing is going to be true when we're running instructions on our processor. We don't really care how long it takes to run one instruction from beginning to end. We care about the rate at which we can complete a large number of instructions, taking into account that their work is going to end up overlapping. And so if we call the time from beginning to end latency, should follow that we probably have a name that I'm going to for the time at which that represents the rate at which things finish or complete or start. And that's going to be throughput. So the throughput is what we're going to call the rate at which sort of all the operations finish overall. And one way we can measure that is that once we've sort of started doing our lots of loads of laundry or lots of instructions, what's the time in between when we finish one load to when we finish the next one? We could also look at what's the time between when we start one load in the dryer and one load in the next load in the dryer, or when we start in the washer. Because all of these, once we get started, are going to be the same, right? We have to advance kind of in lockstep because we're going to be waiting. If we're just starting, we can't start until the next step is free, and that step can't start until the step after that is free. And if we're at the end, we can't start until the previous step finishes. So we're always going to be kind of limited by how fast the slowest step is. And that also means that if I want to figure out what's my throughput, I can look anywhere at any step, and I'm going to see the same thing. Question? Can I say the pipeline latency versus regular latency? Sure. So with latency, I'm talking about the time from starting one operation, like a load of laundry or an instruction, to finishing it. And once our pipeline gets started, I have this kind of dead time here, because I have to wait for the first, the previous operation to finish using the dryer before I can actually advance. And even if the dryer was free, like if we had the next step was taking longer, that it we would have to wait to use the dryer, not because the dryer wasn't free, but because the folding table isn't free. And so that extra time means our time from beginning to end, if I look at an individual load of laundry, is higher. So if I think of, like, you know, someone else is doing your load of laundry for you, you know, this means that the time from when you give them your laundry to when you get it back, that's going to be higher, right? If they're doing it this way with lots of other loads versus if they just do it alone. And that's the sort of thing our latency is measuring, and our pipeline latency ends up being higher than it would be if we weren't doing this pipelining thing. We didn't have any other instructions to run at the same time. Does that answer your question? Okay. But for typical programs, and most of the time when we're doing loads of laundry, what we care about is this throughput. And for programs, we definitely care about this throughput more because, you know, if a program takes a second to run, that's probably like a billion instructions. And we care how long those billion instructions take, not how long individual instructions in those billions take. And because we have the instructions overlapping their work, if we take the amount of time each of those billion instructions and tape and add them together, that's going to be much bigger than the total time it takes to run the billion instruction program. Questions about throughput? Okay, so let's talk about applying this idea of pipelining that we've seen as kind of intuitive thing we do with laundry to our processor. And to do that, I'm going to want to divide my steps of the instruction into what we'll call stages. Yeah. So we have our equivalent of our washer and dryer here. And I'm going to use kind of the most common division of stages that early pipeline processors use, and that's still, you know, relatively common in simpler processors. And so we're going to have what we'll call the fetch stage, where we read the machine code for the instruction, and also where we compute the address of the instruction to run next. You might notice in this diagram I'm not handling jumps. We'll talk about those later. I'm just keeping things simpler in the picture by, you know, not showing how jumps would be handled. Then we read the registers. And every source you'll see about this, maybe not every, but almost every source you'll see about pipelining, calls a stage where we read the registers, the code stage, even if there's no actual, like, reading opcode stuff. So that's the term I'm going to use, but the main thing we're doing in this stage is reading the registers. By the registers, I mean the ones you see in assembly that isn't the program counter. We already read the program counter. Now we're reading, like, R8, R9, RAX, and so on. Then the next step we'll call execute is where we're going to do mathematical operations. So for like an add or XOR, the actual addition or XOR. And for something like a move instruction, this is where we're going to compute the address at which to access memory. Then I have a memory stage, which is where we access the data cache. And you might say, well, some instructions don't need to do that. That's fine. We're going to still have a memory stage for them. And we'll sometimes just pass the value through without changing it. And You might say, couldn't we like optimize things by skipping the memory stage when we don't need it? You can. That's like not a completely crazy idea, but in practice, it's not worth doing. And the main reason why is that, you know, some portion of our instructions are going to need the memory stage, and we're going to have to wait behind them anyways. And so there's not really much benefit to having some clever way of sometimes skipping it when, if they're, you know, when we're going to have to wait for it if, you know, any of the prior four instructions use the memory stage. So in practice, we'll just always use that memory stage, even if we're just passing the value through instead of actually using the data cache, just to make sure we're in sync with the previous and next instruction all the time. And then finally, I'll have a last stage we'll call writeback, where we write to the register file if we need to. And you might say, okay, so we divide things up this way, and your intuition might be, okay, so that means that let's think about, we have this value here. Do we have, say, this value here? Oh, wrong one. So you might say, so what we're going to do is we're going to set things up such that, you know, let's say I read the read and add instruction. So I have my, you know, my PC signal, which is going to be X100, and then, so I'll send that, I'll have my instruction cache output, and after I send the OX100, it's going to tell me the value of the instruction value, so it's like going to be like R add, R8, R9, and then after that, I will get sort of my, you know, R8 value and R9 value. And we'd have some sort of timeline where I'd set the PC to 100 here, and then I'd set it to 108. You know, if that's the next instruction, then 110. And we'd have the same thing happening here. We read the first instruction, and let's say the next instruction's a move, we read that, you know, and we'd have just things advance like you kind of saw in my line through diagram. There's a functional problem here. And the problem is that if we think of kind of what's going on right here, our register file is trying to read the values 8 and 9 because it saw 8 and 9. It wants you to read 8 and 9. So it says 8 and 9, and it's outputting the values for that. And then its inputs change. What's it actually going to do? Well, our timeline is more likely to be that we have the values for 8 and 9, and then it changes over to the new values while we're trying to use the values to do the addition. Or similarly, because we're not keeping this in sync. Or similarly, another issue that's the same, sort of a version of the same issue, is if we just think of our instruction cache, my notion here is I'd have R8, R9, but what's actually going to happen is the instruction cache is going to see, oh, you know you want 108, let me fix that. And so while we're trying to use that machine code, the instruction cache is going to change it on us. So when I said that, like, after, when I get back to this diagram here, like I gave us a notion that, oh, after we get 8 and 9 here, the instruction cache isn't doing anything. But that's not true. The instruction cache is doing the work of holding the values 8 and 9 constant so the rest of the circuit can do its job. And after we read, say, 800 and 900, the register file isn't, like, it's not actively reading anymore, but it's doing the work of holding those values there so we can use them. And if we just try to naively add pipelining by kind of advancing our program counter, you know, we're going to mess up those values being held constant so we can actually use them in the circuits. So our solution to this problem is going to be that we add extra registers just to hold the values. So the idea is while that we're going to get the values for the first instruction here, and then we're going to put them in the register so that we can output those values while computing the values for the next instruction. So we don't have any interference from, you know, losing the values that we just got computed while we're computing the new ones. And we're going to add these registers to store these values and hold them constant between every set of stages. So I have ones, in this case, between fetch and decode, between decode and execute, execute in memory, and memory and write. And the purpose of this is that we need to hold the values constant while we're working on them and make sure that we only advance to the next step when everyone is ready and that all the values advance at the same time. We have to keep those in sync. Our registers are going to be our way of doing that. We can't just kind of adjust the timing willy-nilly and expect things to actually work, because circuits are going to get confused by values changing and they're not going to be stable. Some questions about our pipeline registers here. So let's look at how this works for running sort of this sequence of instructions here. And I have this timeline at the bottom here where we have time is going in this direction. And therefore we have different cycles, and as every clock cycle, we kind of update the values in every single register all at once. So initially, we have our PC contains address 100. We send that to our instruction cache, and we get out our actual instruction data. And so in this case, that's going to like tell this, is this an add, and tell us the register numbers 8 and 9. But we're not going to act on that yet. We're going to wait until the next cycle to use that. So these are input to the fetch to the code registers. And at the same time, we have input to our PC register, the address of the next instruction. Then when we advance to cycle number 1, now we have our 8 and 9 that we input previously. Now they're being output by the fetch to the code registers. And also, the 108 address we just computed that we were inputting to the PC here, now it's copied into the register, and so it's outputting 108. And so this means, as we were kind of intending, that we're going to do the second step of our add instruction, the register read, at the same time as we do the first step of the move instruction, the fetch. So we're going to be reading the instruction cache address 108, and inputting our 10 and 11 here, you know, the register numbers from that instruction. At the same time as while the register file is not seeing registers 10 and 11 yet, it's using register numbers 8 and 9. And the register file is going to compute the result from the values at 8 and 9, let's say they're 800 and 900, and prepare them to be used by the execute stage in the next cycle, but they're not going to go there yet. They're going to be sitting on the input to the registers until we go to cycle 2. And at the same time, we've also prepared our next instruction address, 110, as the input to the PC. So then when we advance to cycle 2, now our program counter is outputting 110, meaning that our fetch stage is doing the work for the XOR. It's reading the XOR instruction. And Our decode stage is getting the register number 10 that it needs to compute the memory address for this move instruction. And our execute stage is doing the add instructions work of adding the two register values that we collected previously. And all these stages are getting their inputs from the registers we added before them. You know, versus our single cycle design, they were getting it directly from the previous component. Can't do that anymore because the previous component's busy computing the new values. So they're getting the values that were computed last cycle using these registers. Question? So the question is, if the decode stage takes really long, how do we store that the fetch stage stays in sync?
Yeah.
We're going to have a single clock that's going to decide when to advance all the registers. And so we will always advance all the registers to their next value in lockstep. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? And if we continue, so here I have my decode stage reading register 10 while I'm reading the XOR instruction for the XOR and while I'm adding 900. In the next cycle, we'll have our sum just pass through the memory stage without being changed. We'll still have the memory stage because, you know, it's not worth trying to skip it, mainly because, well, you know, if the previous instruction or the instruction before that used the memory stage, we kind of have to stay in sync with that. And we wouldn't be able to skip it in practice very often anyways. So it's not worth the extra logic. We won't do that. We'll just pass it through the memory stage, even though we're not using the instruction cache. And while we're passing that value through, our execute stage will do the memory address computation for the move, and our decode stage will read the register values for the XOR. And in the next cycle, cycle 4, we'll finally write back the result of the add, meaning we'll update the actual register file, so update the value for R9, and at the same time, we'll be doing the XOR's computation and actually accessing the data cache for the move instruction. And so we just have all the instructions advance one behind another, and, you know, if I made this diagram more complete, we'd have a instruction whatever was here would be next in decode, and we have an instruction after that in fetch. And kind of all the parts of our processor would be busy essentially all the time. So questions? Our execution of our pipeline. Okay. So, talked a bit about this. So, I mentioned that we're going to have sort of a single clock that decides when to advance. So let's assume we set that clock to run every 500 picoseconds. What is the latency of one instruction here? Like some more time. So who thinks A, B, C, D, E? So most people say D, that's what I got. So latency, remember, is time from beginning to end. And we're gonna generally assume that the last stage, we need the whole stage, even though, yeah, technically you might not need all of it. So if we assume we need all of the last stage, then, you know, each instruction here is going to, you know, start, you know, in one cycle and finish five cycles later. So it needs five whole cycles to run. And each cycle with this clock setting has a time of 500 picoseconds. you know, even if it's the memory stage that's doing nothing for the on instruction, still takes 500 picoseconds because that's what the clock's set to. And the clock has to be set that way because something's using the memory stage or using one of the other stages at that time, so we can't make it shorter. So we end up with a latency of 2500 picoseconds. Now, as we mentioned at the beginning, this is not the number we probably really care about. What we really care about is probably the throughput, the rate which we complete instructions overall. So what is our throughput? And let's assume that we don't have anything like cache misses, which obviously would not help our throughput, and we'd have to deal with in some way. Let's just assume we don't have any of that. We're just, you know, starting one instruction right after the other. We don't have to wait for a slow cache or something like that. So who thinks our throughput is A, one instruction every 100 picoseconds, B, C, D, E, no clue. Okay, so I would say B is the right answer. So something which might be a little disconcerting here is that if you look at this diagram, you might say, oh, 0 to 5, that's 6 times 500 picoseconds over two instructions. The reason we're not going to do that is that we're going to kind of assume when we're measuring throughput, we're measuring kind of throughput for a long sequence of instructions. So we really mean that there's like lots of instructions above and below, and kind of in our steady state, we're going to end up completing one instruction every 500 picoseconds. And so that's the number we'll say. I agree that, like, if we have to consider, oh, I'm just starting the first instructions, yeah, that's going to, like, decrease the instructions over time number, just change that. But, you know, kind of when we're thinking about processors, that's not really a concern we're going to have because, well, we're running, like, billions of instructions. That startup time is not going to matter. Even though, yeah, we could try to measure it, but if we try to measure it for, like, a real processor, it's going to be so tiny that, you know, we're not going to care. So we talked about sort of dividing up our processor into steps, and I chose kind of the steps that looked simplest to do given the picture I showed you of the processor design. But we could maybe do something else. So let's say I figure out how to divide each of those steps in half. So, you know, I figure out, say, oh, the instruction cache access are divided into two parts, and the register file read are divided into two parts, and so on. So instead of having 5 stages, we have 10. What is our throughput after we do that? And we're also assuming we decrease the cycle time from 500 picoseconds to 2. And doing this, we halve the time because we're doing half the work. So we'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks our answer is A? That's now 1 every 100 picoseconds or so. B, 1 every 250. C, 1 every 1,000. D, 1 every 5,000. E, something else. For that, no clue. Okay, so most people said 1 every 250, and that's what I get. Our cycle time is 250, and kind of in our best case, our good case, right, we're gonna start a new instruction every cycle. We're gonna finish a new instruction every cycle. If you kind of look up what would be happening before here, we'd have some instruction in F1, you know, in every cycle before here. You know, if we're ignoring the relatively small kind of startup cost of like actually starting, you know, the first 10 instructions, then kind of once things get going, we're running a new instruction every 250 picoseconds, every clock cycle. Question? Would you not count both F1 and F2 and F2 and F1 instructions too? So our assumption here is that we've divided up our what previously was one stage into two. So for example, maybe our instruction cache in F1, maybe we read the cache set, and in F2 we compare the tags and use the block offset bits, for example. And the idea of doing that would be that we could be reading the cache set for the next instruction while we're comparing the tags for the previous one.
So is throughput based more on the stages than the actual like instructions into the CPU?
So the throughput, yeah. So our sort of best case throughput assumes that we like always, like each stage is doing a different instruction because that's the best we can do, right? And so far we haven't seen a reason not to have each stage doing a different instruction. We'll talk later about maybe there's some problems there, but you know, kind of in our best case, like each stage is doing a different instruction, even if they're both part of the fetch operation. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So a kind of assumption I made here is that when we sort of divide all the stages in half, our cycle time goes in half. And that is not actually realistic. And there's two problems with that. So one problem with that is that we have these pipeline registers, and pipeline registers in general, like, they aren't free. They're physical pieces of hardware that don't work instantaneously. And this means, for example, if I have, you know, 100 picoseconds of logic, you know, like maybe that's the time for my instruction cache. And even if I divide that logic perfectly in half, to do our pipelining, we need to add these registers in between our stages to store the values so we could work on one thing in the next stage while the previous stage works on the next thing. This register might take some amount of time. So in this picture, I'm saying the register needs 10 picoseconds to kind of store a value stably. Well, that means that even though I've kind of divided up my actual work in half here, I went from 110 to 60 picoseconds per cycle. I didn't have it. I did a little worse. And this problem gets way, way worse if we think of like kind of taking it to its logical extreme of having like a huge number of pipeline stages. Well, all of a sudden, you know, we're going to spend most of our cycle time waiting for the registers and not doing useful work. We aren't going to kind of, having 10 times the stages is not going to give us nearly 10 times the performance. The other issue is that I'm assuming here that I can divide up the sort of work for each stage exactly in half. And this is often going to be challenging. So I talked about like for reading a cache, you might say the first part is getting the correct line set from the cache, and the second part is like comparing tags and doing the shifting to deal with the offset bits. Those probably are not going to take the same amount of time, right? It's probably not going to exactly divide things in half. So we'll end up with some sort of splitting where, you know, we don't end up taking 100 picoseconds of work and dividing it into exactly 250 picosecond segments. It might be like 60 and 45 or something like that. And it might be especially challenging because there's a bunch of things we're doing this diagram which seemed hard to split up. Like, how do we split up reading the register file into two parts or adding a value? It's probably not going to be split up evenly if it's even practical to split up. And this sort of makes our improvement worse because now I'm limited by the slowest part here. So I divided things up into 60 and 45. My 60 picosecond stage is now kind of like my dryer. It's going to determine my actual throughput because even though I only have 45 picoseconds of work in the next stage, I can't give it work fast enough to do. And if I swap the two, even though my first stage would have been 45 after swapping the two stages, the next stage would, we'd be waiting to give it work. So we'd end up in either case that our cycle time would be 70 picoseconds, not 60. And this is likely to sort of be more and more significant the more we try to subdivide our stages. Questions? These diminishing returns. So these reasons why we don't kind of get, the kind of intuition is we divide it up into five pieces, it runs five times as fast. This is not going to quite work. Okay. So let's say I do my division here, and instead of getting my perfect 250 picoseconds, half the cycle time, every stage takes 240 except the M11, which takes 350. I couldn't figure out how to split up my data cache exactly in half. And so the first half of the data cache work takes a lot longer. What is my new throughput? We'd like some more time. So who thinks A, B, C, D, E? No clue. Okay, so we have somewhat of a split between C and D. And the answer I get is C. So the intuition with D is that D is just saying, well, the average time per stage, is not 350. It's that quantity there that we can compute by, 9 times 240 plus 350 divided by 10. And to think of, why can't we get the average time per stage? Why is our throughput worse than that? We can go back to our laundry example. That if I'm looking here, the throughput I actually get ends up being determined by my dryer here, even though my washer and my folding table are much faster to operate. And we're going to have the same scenario with this case, which is that you know, even though, you know, this M1 stage is kind of, is the slowest and everything else is faster, our execute two stage can't go any faster because it has to wait for the M1 stage to be available to usefully advance. And our M2 stage, even though it goes faster, can't actually run that fast because it has to wait for the input from the M1 stage to be computed, which is always going to take another 350 picoseconds. Now, the other complaint you might have is, well, surely, you know, it doesn't always take 350 picoseconds, right? Because when we aren't actually accessing the data cache, we don't need it. And I think that's a legitimate complaint. And we could imagine making a processor where we somehow figure out, you know, whether we can adjust the cycle time downwards. Now, the biggest problem with that, I think, is that, well, when can we actually, go faster? When none of the 10 instructions, when none of the instructions kind of are using that memory cache, which is that data cache, which is kind of any of the instructions in the pipeline. So like we can't actually kind of effectively sort of increase our time that often, because once we have one instruction using it, kind of it slows down everything before it. You know, the next 8 instructions are now slower. So we wouldn't actually be able to use this feature very often, because most programs kind of access load and store values pretty often. The other thing is that most processors like just haven't found it useful from an efficiency point of view to try to vary the clock speed based on kind of an instruction by instruction basis. You may know that a lot of processors have variable clock rates. Those are typically for kind of heat reasons and things like that. And they vary on like the time scale of like seconds, not on a time scale of like single instructions. So generally, all the processors will care about will have effectively a fixed clock rate. No, or clock rate that if it varies, it varies based on like the temperature, not based on what instructions we're running exactly. So, we'll end up paying for this 350 picosecond stage, kind of regardless of what instructions we're running in practice. Questions? Here. Okay, so let's talk about one correctness issue that I kind of glossed over. So that issue here is that we have R8, R9 added together, and let's say then I try to use R9 to add to R8. And what should happen here is that I should, let's say R8 is 800, R9 is 900, we should compute a new R9 is 1700, and then use that at 800 to compute another new, this should be R8, to compute a new R8, which is 2500. But if we think about how our pipeline actually executes, I have a diagram here where time goes down, and I'm showing the contents of the registers that are in our processor. So initially our program counter is 0, so in cycle 0, we're reading the machine code for the add, and we're gonna get kind of 8 and 9 as the registers to read, which means in cycle 1, I have registers 8 and 9 in the fetch to the code registers, saying that, okay, in cycle 1, we're gonna be reading register 8 and register 9 for the first add instruction. And while we're doing that, the second add instruction is going to fetch its value, its machine code, I should say, and it's going to figure out that it needs to read from registers 9 and 8. Okay. And then in the next cycle, cycle 2, we're going to read from registers 9 and 8 for the second add instruction while we're computing 800 plus 900 for the first one. And then we have a problem because, well, when we read for the second add instruction R9, we read 900. And that's wrong. That should be 1700, the way our instructions used to execute when we had our original CS01 style processor design. But the problem is we read the value before it was actually written because we didn't wait for the previous instruction to finish. And not waiting for the previous instruction to finish was the whole performance optimization we were doing. And so this is a problem where we're getting the wrong result. And we call this situation a data hazard. So a hazard is a general term we'll use for a case where when we add this pipelining idea, unless we do some fixes, we get the wrong result. A data hazard is one that has to do with data values being wrong. And one way of thinking about it is that the way we implemented this sequence of instructions is that we decided that we'd read R8 and R9 for the first instruction, then read R9 and R8 for the second instruction, then write R9 for the first instruction, then write R9 for the second instruction. But the manual we gave assembly programmers said, the way an add works is it first reads its values, then it adds, then it writes, and only then do we move on to the next instruction. So we have this disagreement between what we told the assembly programmers our instruction does and what this implementation actually does. And obviously, we need to fix that. It's not acceptable for our processor to compute the wrong values. And there's kind of two solutions we can have here. So the simplest, I guess, three solutions we'll talk about. Two simple solutions, simple-ish solutions. Maybe not that simple to actually implement. So the simplest solution for the hardware maker is to say, well, the problem here is that someone wrote this specification that said an add instruction writes its values before the next add instruction starts. That's not how the hardware works, so that shouldn't be the specification. We'll just write that the way add instructions work is that they take two values, add them together, and three instructions later, that value's available. And your job, compiler writer or assembly writer, is to make sure you pay attention to that. So if you actually wanted to do that sequence of adds, what you really should have done is written two knocks in between. And you might say, this is crazy. Why are we defining an add instruction to add, like, but in the future? That seems, unusable. And that's a reasonable opinion. But there were a few processors that actually used this strategy, where they just said, our instructions, they just don't write their values right away. And you, as an assembly writer or compiler writer, need to write your assembly to take this into account. And this is certainly the least work for the hardware designers to do this and has some efficiency advantages. But for the most part, we've not used this strategy because even though a few processors did it, most of the time we find this unacceptable. And there are kind of two practical issues. So one thing is that even for compiler writers, dealing with instructions that work in this kind of delayed way is a challenge, and they don't do it very efficiently. And same thing is usually true of like hand assembly writers. The other big issue is that, I said three instructions because of the way I divided up this processor into stages. If I change that, it might be four instructions or two instructions. And kind of what I'm saying is that every time our processor changes, you need to recompile everything or rewrite your assembly. And there was a time when people in academia thought that we could get away with this, that we just, recompile things for a new processor. But the reality has turned out to be that it's really important to not require recompilation all the time. And so for those two reasons, this is not the strategy that's actually used kind of today. And one note here, I'm saying three instructions later, and I'm actually, when I'm to only have two knots here, I'm making an assumption that we can read a value as it's being written. And if you think about what happened for our CSO1 design, This has to actually mean we changed how the register file works, because for running one instruction at a time, we need to write a value and not read back the value we're writing, or else the add has this we add one and one, and then we see the two, and then we add two and one, and three and one. We don't want that to happen. So with a single cycle design, our register file would not work this way. This is actually, we've changed the register file to work better, and we still have two nums. If we didn't change it, we'd have a third num. So what's our solution going to be to not have to have our compiler and assembly authors change things? The kind of simplest thing for the hardware to do that doesn't involve telling our compiler and assembly authors everything got more complicated is that the hardware will do what we're telling them to do and detect if there's this situation and insert nops itself. And we call this idea stalling, that basically we're not going to run the add instruction that second until we know that its values are ready in time. And to implement this in the hardware, what we'll probably do is we'll look at the register numbers of the instructions that are sort of in the different stages of the pipeline and compare them. And if we see, the register that this instruction is writing equals the one we're trying to read, we'll stop that instruction from advancing, we'll stop ourselves from fetching new instructions and just keep it around, waiting in an earlier stage until its value is ready. Questions?
Yeah.
This. Yes.
So is that a no-ops add more cycles to our
question? Do the no-ops add more cycles? Yes. So now we will have some cycles where we're not starting new instructions, so we'll have a lower throughput.
Would that be the same as just using the single cluster cycles from
CSO1? So question is, will the performance be the same as the single cycle processor? So it could be better or worse. If we approximately divide it up into equally sized stages, it's probably better because, even though we're taking sort of two cycles off, each of those cycles is about a fifth the time it used to take, probably a little more than a fifth. It could be worse because I said about a fifth, but a little more, right? If that is enough a little more, that would be a problem. Does that answer your question? Okay, so I mentioned that this is our data hazard solution. And this idea of adding nops to wait for things is also probably how we're gonna resolve the simplest way we can resolve other hazards. So another type of hazard that we'll talk about is a control hazard. So here, this is not about our actual pieces of data. Here, the question is, if I'm running this in iPipeline, I need to figure out what instruction to fetch after the JE. And, the problem is that when I want to fetch that instruction, I'm just then computing the comparison. Right? I want to know what instruction to get, but I haven't even compared 800 and 900 yet to know that. And we call this a control hazard, where we don't even know what instruction to fetch yet because it hasn't been computed in time. So what do we do about that? We can do the stalling solution that we saw for data hazards for this. So we can say, we're going to need some time to actually compute the value. So we'll wait until the address of the next instruction to run is computed. So in this example, our compare is going to compute the flags in the execute stage in cycle 2. Then the jump.equal will look at those flags in its execute stage and compute what address do we actually go to next. And then after that, we can actually use that to fetch the correct next instruction. And while we're waiting, we just do nothing instead of actually fetching a new instruction. So questions about this stalling idea applied to our conditional jump, where we have this control hazard, we didn't know what to run against. Okay, so the stalling solution kind of generically solves our hazards. As kind of our final two topics for pipelining, we're going to talk about two better solutions. And we're first going to talk about a better solution for control hazards. And then we'll talk about one for data hazards. So for control hazards, we can do better by, instead of just spending two cycles doing nothing, we can make a guess. And if our guess is right, we're two cycles faster. And if our guess is wrong, well, then we have a problem, right? That we're running instructions that we should never have run. So if our guess is wrong, we're just going to make sure we undo the guess and pretend it didn't happen. And we'll be able to undo the guess after two cycles, so it will be just as fast as it would have been if we waited in that case. So the way this might work is that when we guess right, we just fetch the instructions right. So here, my guess is that the jump is not taken. We just go to the next, we don't go to the label. In that case, you know, if we just guess that and keep going, you know, once we just let the jump figure out, oh, you actually were supposed to go to the XOR, and we just say, okay, everything's fine, let's just keep going. But sometimes, of course, that won't happen, and in that case, what we'll do is we'll, once we figure out where the jump actually goes, we'll cancel our in-progress instructions and replace them with a no operation. Just as if we kind of did nothing, but we're doing it retroactively. And the idea here is that, well, how does how does canceling this instruction work? Well, we're just discarding the values that we fetched from register so far, or fetched from the instruction cache. We haven't actually like written anything or modified memory, so it's actually really trivial to undo these partial instructions, because that's just forgetting the intermediate values we computed. So we call this idea of undoing these partial instructions squashing them. So we get rid of them and then go to the correct instruction. So in this case, yes, it's slower, but it's just as slow as it was when we were inserting, when we're just doing nothing, right? Questions about this prediction, speculation idea. So we're guessing what instructions to run. When we guess right, we're faster. When we guess wrong, we're just as slow as we were when we were stalling, waiting for the actual value, because that's when we fix our guess. And we just have to do the extra work of sort of getting rid of the instructions we weren't supposed to run. And in our five-stage pipeline, getting rid of those instructions is really simple, because it's just taking the values that we've computed so far and discarding them. We don't have to like update the register file. We don't have to update caches. We just like take the values that we're passing between the pipeline stages and replace them with like zeros. And I say, I guess that's not really simple. Maybe it's simple, but it's really simple compared to some more complicated pipelines we'll talk about later, where undoing these instructions might involve like undoing a value we've written somewhere. That's way more complicated. And we'll talk about kind of strategies for that, you know, next week when we talk about kind of more modern processor designs. Okay, so in our last few minutes, I'll introduce our idea of forwarding, which is going to be the second kind of trick for dealing with hazards we'll talk about, and this will deal with data hazards. And the observation we made in our example of R8 and R9 and R9 and R8 is that this was supposed to compute R9 becomes 1700, and this was supposed to read 1700. And it turns out that when we're about to compute the second adds values, that what the value we read that was wrong is, it's around at the same time as the value that we just computed that we want to use, right? We actually have computed the new value for R9 already. We just haven't written it to the registers yet. So what we can do is we can say, well, I just need to recognize that this value that I've read here is supposed to be the one we've already computed but haven't written back yet. And I can add an extra wire to my processor. And of course, I don't always want to use that value, so I'm going to add a mux. And basically, whenever I just read a value that we know is going to be overwritten later, I find the value it's going to be overwritten with, send it back, and use that instead of the value we just read. And this idea is called forwarding. So I think I'm out of time. So you may notice, like, I'm only taking the value from here. There's some other places we could take the value from. We'll talk about those. And then we'll talk about sort of cases that forwarding doesn't handle and what that looks like. And that will be what we'll talk about next time.